The story I'm going to tell today, and this is not going to be preaching time. This could be an extended testimony, basically. Since 2016, I've been all over the country telling this story, from Oregon to Florida to Pennsylvania to Oklahoma, Iowa, all over the place. In 2015, I was the winner of season 2 of Alone on the History Channel. Anybody ever hear of this show before? Okay, some of you haven't. Just to give it a fill in that blank there. The Alone is considered to be the wilderness, the Olympics of wilderness survival in the world. That they take 10 contestants, and they drop you completely by yourself in a wilderness area, and there's no camera crew filming you. There's no one there to support you. No contact with the outside world. You're just basically there, living off the land as long as you possibly can, while filming the entire experience. And you can tap out any time. You have a satellite phone. You can call the rescue crew, and they'll come and get you and take you out of the experience at any point. But
what season was that?
Season 2. Yeah, they filmed it in 2015, and it was aired in 2016. But let me back up a little bit. We're going to winning the Olympics of Wilderness Survival on a national, actually international TV show is like that's a diamond. That's a mountaintop experience, let me tell you. But if you were going to buy a diamond, you wouldn't go to the jeweler. If you go to the jeweler, he's not going to take that diamond he wants to sell you and lay it down on a glass countertop and have you look at it. What he's going to do is he's going to take a piece of black felt and he's going to lay that down, that black velvet. He's going to put that diamond in the middle of a very dark place. That way it stands out and you can see exactly what it is. And kind of my life story is that way. This experience of winning Alone is the diamond on a very dark black background. I grew up and was fascinated by American Indians as hunting, fishing, trapping, doing all that outside stuff. I was fascinated by American Indians as a kid. In our garden, we would have artifacts come up. We used to live on a village site, and just fascinated with American Indians and always out in the woods and doing things. When I was 16 years old, I got into wilderness survival, learning, life was kind of rough at the McIntyre household. My dad was an alcoholic, and we had a house up in the mountains, and on the way to the mountain house, my brother and I would just say, hey, just drop us off on the mountain, and you guys go on to the house, and then pick us up on Sunday. So we'd spend every weekend in the summer just out in the woods and just living out there and doing, we made a lot of mistakes, too, and it kind of lit a fire under me. How do you survive in the wilderness? How do you go out there and live off the land and use the natural resources and take the right things with you so you're not constantly suffering in the wilderness? That was about 15, 16 years old. I also received Christ. So the wilderness and Jesus Christ became two rails in my life that just ran parallel for the rest of my life. Always interested in the wilderness, in love with Jesus. And those two things just kind of weave their way all the way through my story. I got saved when I was 16 then, and fast forward a few years, I'm at Baptist Bible College in Clark Summit, Pennsylvania, engaged to a girl who was a missionary kid, and grew up in Brazil. And the first year we were married, we moved down to Brazil. I taught American kids down there, had a degree in secondary education. I taught American kids in Brazil for 2 years, and it was during that time that God called me to be a missionary to Brazil. And I told him, okay, I'll go home and be a Christian school teacher. Do not do that, okay? If you know what God's telling you to do, you do it, no matter how scary it seems. But he called me at the point where I'd been there for 2 years. I was ready to go home. There were some deer in Pennsylvania that were still alive. They hadn't been shot yet. And I wasn't there to do it. And so I was really looking forward to going home. And he's saying, no, you're going to be a missionary in Brazil. And he put us in a Christian school, which was the worst Christian school in the United States. I won't give the name, but it's a red flag when all of the teachers are being replaced every year. Just file that away if you're ever interviewing for a school. Ask, why? How many teachers are you replacing this year? If it's all of them, walk. Anyway, we were there for 2 years, and it was extremely difficult. In between those 2 school years, though, since I was being paid for the whole year, my wife was also working there as well, we're still getting our paycheck in the summer. We went back to Brazil in 1994, and I realized this is the place I need to be. And all my Portuguese came back, and I just felt like I was at home there. And so we came back and decided to apply as missionaries at the Association of Baptist World Evangelism, ABWE, out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in 1995. We candidated there and were accepted as missionaries. And that meant a change in career. I went to First Baptist Church of Perkasie, where I was did a pastoral internship for 2.5 years and became an ordained Baptist pastor. And that was a lot of work. After that, we raised support for 2.5 years to raise up all the money we needed to fund the missionary work we're doing and buy a vehicle and all that stuff in Brazil. So now it's 1999 with our second daughter in tow. Our first daughter, Erin, was born in Brazil in 1991. And then Karina was born in 1999 there in Pennsylvania. So we had a 3-month-old baby, and finally we're released to go back to the field and go to Brazil. That was huge, because I knew I was going back into, Brazil is a very beautiful place, but it's also a very difficult place. Now, we are going to the city of Belo Horizonte, Brazil. Has anybody here, other than Josiah, heard of this city? You've heard of Finland, right? Horizonte, okay, yeah, you were born there, right. You've heard of Finland, right? The nation of Finland? Finland has 5.5 million people. You've heard of Ireland, right? Ireland has 4.8 million people. The city of Belo Horizonte has 5.5 million people in the greater Belo area. So it's a people group about the same population as the as nations. You know, there are nations in this world a lot smaller than Belo. And I was called down there. I was going to be a youth pastor in a church downtown in the urban jungle. And my first thing, I get to Brazil, I have to do a 1-year language study with a private tutor, 1 full year, working 5 days a week with a private tutor and learning the language, and then also had to do a 1-year internship at a Brazilian church downtown. So you imagine the amount of preparation that goes into being minimally qualified to begin your career as a missionary. We're talking about a 10-year period of just preparation. Just, 4-year degree, pastoral internship, raising the support, language study, another internship. It's a lot. You don't just say, oh, I'm going to be a missionary and get on a plane and go, other than Josiah. Who did that? But now he's going back the formal way. So yeah, Anyway, it's a lot. It's not just a spur of the moment kind of thing. It takes dedication to get to that point. And so I begin working in this downtown church as a youth pastor in Belo Horizonte, Brazil. And I'm loving the ministry, but hating the city. I am a creature of the wilderness. I am most comfortable in a forest somewhere, And it's just stress for me. So my father-in-law saw that I was kind of falling apart. He's like, hey, we need to get you out in the woods. We're going to get you into some wilderness. And he got me in the car, and we just went exploring. And we went about an hour south of Belo Horizonte, and all of a sudden, we're in the howling wilderness. It is just wild land. It is just the wilderness. And we found this place where I could park at this one ranch. And in the rainy season, if I went downhill, I was in a rainforest, jungle. In the dry season, they don't have 4 seasons there. You only have rainy and dry. In dry season, if I hiked up into the mid-level elevation, I was in desert, in the same place. It's just the rain shuts off and the upper land drains. This stays a forest. That turns into desert scrub. And above this was mountains that went up to 6,000 feet. And above 4,500 feet, there's a tropical alpine ecosystem there, which is totally different. I mean, it was heaven for me. As a wilderness survival terrain junkie, this is like, oh my goodness. And I started going out there. Every time I start getting stressed out, I'd take a day off. I'd go out there and take all these pictures and camp out for the night. And of course, I'm showing these pictures to my kids in the youth group. And they're like, Pastor Mac, you got to take us out there. You got to, take us to these places. And I'm like, okay, we'll do this. So I cobbled together some gear, and I got about 9 or 10 of these guys together, and we went camping for 2 nights out in this. It was a disaster. It was horrible. These guys had never set foot off the pavement in their lives. They were just as green could be. They're doing things that were stupid. They're going to come back in a bag. And I get them home, and I'm like, never again. Never again. And they are whooping it up with all the other kids and saying how cool it was. And they're like, take us out back, take us back, So I'm like, all right, I'm going to take you guys back out in the woods, out in the bush, but I'm going to teach you basic wilderness survival. I'm going to teach you how to handle yourselves out there because you know nothing, and I'm afraid. And I took them out there. I came up with a curriculum and all that and realized, okay, a lot of these things have spiritual applications too. So I can, like walking with a compass and always knowing your having your point of reference and keeping that in sight. You know, there's a lot of things. The bush is a classroom. You make your bed and you lie in it. Cause and effect happen right now. I don't have to make them do push-ups or anything, getting ahead of myself, but I take the guys out there, and we got all the gear and stuff like that. I said, guys, take a look around. Do you see your mother here? They're like, no. I said, right, I am not your mother. I'm here to train you how to handle yourselves, and this is the way it works. I'm going to do the thing, and you're going to watch me do the thing, and the very next time that thing has to be done, you will be doing the thing, because I'm not here to carry your water, I'm not here to chop your firewood, I'm not here to build your shelter or make your bed or hold your hand. I'm here to teach you to do for yourselves what I know how to do. And bing, this light bulb goes off in my head. You're a missionary. This is exactly what you should be doing. You can't evangelize 185 million Brazilians, but you can train these Brazilians to what you know and have them doing the work. So it's not my job to do the work. It's my job to teach them to do the work and hold fast to that. And that is my North Star here as a missionary, is to always train people. Never do the work for them. Always train them how to do the work. And that was the beginning of the Per Ardua Wilderness Ministry. Now, Per Ardua is Latin for through difficulty. And it's also the McIntyre family motto. It's also the motto of the Royal Air Force. And I think that we had it first. So I'm just going to keep it because we're a lot older than the Air Force. Per Ardua, through difficulty. And I know that the most precious things I've learned in my life, I've learned in the hardest times I've been through. The most valuable things I know about my God, I learned those in the midst of my deepest suffering. And that's just a fact. And I wish it was some other way. I wish I could, like, oh, wow, I did that, you know, got this wonderful thing. Someone brought me a new car, and now I know all sorts of stuff about God. No, it doesn't work that way, at least not for me. Maybe I'm just hard-headed, but per ardua, through difficulty. So that the idea being that the deepest lessons we learn in the midst of our struggles. And I didn't have to create those struggles out there in the jungle. You just take the kids out there, and it's the bugs and the thorns and the mosquitoes and the heat, and it's the perfect classroom. I had one exercise I would do with those guys at the very end. They carried a lightweight pack. It may be about 15, 20 pounds. It wasn't a lot of gear because we're surviving. We're not camping. And on the way out, there's one place in particular, there's a river valley where it's like a big gorge. And it's about a 2-mile walk to get down to the bottom, 2 kilometers, I'm sorry, to get down to the bottom of that, about a mile and a half. And on the way out, I would make them draw straws. And the guy who got the short straw had to carry all the packs, including mine. And they're like, and all the kids were laughing, ah, you get to carry all the packs, you're the mule on the sides, and we'll pop. And then we start putting them on. The kid will have like one in the front, he'll have one in the back, he'll have two on the sides, and we'll pile one on top, you know, five, six packs, all weighing about 20 pounds. He's got about 100 pounds of gear on him. And then we start walking out in the 90-degree heat up this slope. And if you get about halfway up, the sunlight hits you. You're out of the jungle, you're climbing, there's a rocky trail. And in the flatland, all those, the kid's doing fine. He'll be carrying that thing, and he'll be marching along and stuff. No, I got it. Always the macho thing. He's got to be the toughest guy around, right? I got it. No, I got it. I can do it. And they're going up. And interestingly, almost every time, it would be the kid who had the most pride and the most self-confidence that would draw that short straw. Mm-hmm. The Lord would hand-pick the guy who had to learn this lesson. So they get about halfway up, and this guy's struggling. The sweat's just pouring out of him, you know, and he's got this 100 and extra pounds of weight, and he's trying to go up these rocky trails. And the other kids they're quiet. They're not making fun of him anymore. They're seeing a friend of theirs really hurt to carry that stuff. And they're like, Pastor Matt, can we get our packs? No, you can't. Come on, you know, can we get the packs, you know? And they're like, Pastor Matt, this isn't fair. I'm like, you're right. It's not fair. Can we get the packs? No, I'd say to the kid, Andre, are you okay with Karen? I'm okay, I'm good. Mm-hmm. He's not good. So up ahead, there was a flat spot where we could all sit down and rest kind of in the semi-shade, and I usually stopped them up there. And I'd say, what's going on here? Why am I doing this to you guys? Now, we don't know. And the guy's just huffing and puffing, sweaty. And I said, guys, this is the average church right here. You got one or two guys that are pulling all the weight, and everyone else is just attending. Everyone else just showing up, being ministered to, not realizing the burden which is being carried by a very small, dedicated core group of your church. And you need to multiply that core group. You need to learn to bear one another's burdens. Bear your own burdens, absolutely, but also bear one another's burdens. Because sometimes you're going up, everyone's carrying their own pack, and there's one guy's got a twisted ankle. He needs someone to carry his pack, doesn't he? Okay, and that's just the way life is, that you bear your own burdens as far as they're bearable, and then there's times you can't bear your own burdens, and the rest of the church has to come in and bear those burdens. And unfortunately, it's usually a very dedicated small group of people in every church which is doing that, and everyone else is kind of oblivious to it. Keep that in mind. Just one lesson. So priority became a constant repeating thing in my ministry in Brazil, and it was wonderful. Not everything was wonderful in Brazil, though. We went down there originally to be a team of five couples, and after a few years, all those couples had resigned or moved to other fields, and leaving just my wife and I. The dollar took a crash. We took a 55% pay cut because of the exchange rate. Imagine how you would be doing right now on 45% of what you're currently making, and that's what happened to us. And it was hard, and it created a lot of stress, so much stress that I opened up Pro Ardua. With a friend of mine, I formed the Bushmaster Wilderness Survival School and actually started taking kids, you know, people out as paying customers because we weren't making it financially. And even then, my kids to this day can't eat baked potatoes because we were living on baked potatoes. And it was hard. Not good. The one thing that really happened, which really, really pulled the rug out from under us, I want to be careful not to share too much detail here because this is a mixed group, okay? So you're all adult enough to know where I'm going with this. Our daughter, my wife, found her diary, and she's 13 years old. She's talking about interested in this boy and that boy and kissing this kid and that kid. And then all of a sudden, there's the involvement of two 28-year-old men who had been grooming her and had been, yeah. It's as bad as you think. And, of course, we told, and these guys were her basically adopted uncles. They lived with my mother and father-in-law for years and years, about 10 years at that point. We're shattered. This rocked us to our core. So, of course, we report this to the mission and told my in-laws about what was going on, and we were not believed. We had an out-of-control daughter. And now we're under the microscope as a family. And it was not a good scene. It was not handled well. After some 2 years of taking my daughter to counseling there in Brazil, she went across the street at our next-door neighbor's house across the street where she had been every day. She goes back and forth. Aaron and Mayada and Jonathan, her little baby, were back in our house, or she was over there, and she tells us, okay, I'm going to go over to Mayada's house to take care of Jonathan. She has a migraine. And I'm just going to give her a break here. And she went over there. Mayada took a medicine to knock out. And we found out that Mayada had an older half-brother who was on the run for killing a federal police officer. He jumped the wall at the house, found Aaron there, and he raped her. So now 2 years into this recovery, all of a sudden she's violently attacked. And, of course, we told the mission, told our ascending church and all this stuff. And it was just further proof that the McIntyres were off the rails. We weren't believed. And we came back for furlough, and the mission told us, okay, if you want to continue, you have to go to counseling, and we have to be able to talk to your counselor. So at this point, we were so beat up. We were not honest to that counselor. We're going to lose everything. If we can't go back to Brazil, I own my own home there. This is my entire career, everything I've done to build this up, and all of a sudden to have someone pull the plug. So at the very time we needed, very much needed counseling, it was an extended interrogation. It was bad. It was just unethical. No other way I can put it. And also my sending church pastor, who had been my mentor for about 15 years, that year was just holding us at arm's length, and I hear him thinking I must have done something wrong, and he doesn't want to talk to me. This is the guy I could tell him anything. And at the end of that year of furlough, he was dismissed for cause for having a relationship with his secretary. And that's why he didn't want me in his life. He didn't want me to discover this. So it's like all of our support system just pulled out from under us. And we were finally released to go back to the field, and I had no business going back to the field at that point. My marriage was in such a state. My relationship with my wife was horrible. We were both just solely focused on getting back to Brazil and keeping our life, that we had lost sight of each other. It was not good. And the upshot of all this, 2012, my wife announced we were getting a divorce, and that was it. End of discussion. And that happened. So all of a sudden, I find myself living here in Grand Rapids. She wanted to be near her parents, so she moved here. If I want to see my kids, I have to live in Michigan. I've never lived here before. And I find myself living in a one-bedroom apartment here in Grand Rapids and inspecting foreclosed homes. I got a job going from one empty home to the next. It was like working after the zombie apocalypse. You know what I mean? The one empty home after the next. I go in there and take pictures and upload them, fix what needs to be fixed, and go home and paying alimony and child support, not making enough. I'm living on like taco shells and canned ham. You know what I mean? It was not a good scene. About a year and a half into doing that, the company announces, we're going out of business. Lost a contract here in Michigan, 17 other states. We sold everything, and you're out of a job here 2 weeks' notice, and you're gone. And at this point, I can't win for losing. You know what I mean? I'm just like, everything. A friend of mine gave me a book called What Color Is Your Parachute? And it's this fierce inventory you take of your own life. What have you ever done? Your education, your experiences, your interests, your hobbies, special skills, life, you know, choices, all this stuff. You put it down, and you get this paper picture of who you are. And this should tell you what kind of job you should be looking for or creating for yourself if it doesn't exist. And I'm like looking at this life, and it's like, this is a former life. Everything on this list has no relevance. Yeah, I speak fluent Portuguese. Okay, in West Michigan, what does that get me? You know, I have a degree in Bible, but I'm a divorced Baptist pastor. And talk about shoot the wounded, that's what happens. You know, you're done. Oh, you're divorced? Your wife left you? I was like, I don't believe in divorce, but I have to believe I'm divorced, right? It happened. Deal with it. Didn't want it. Anyway, I look at this life. What's left? I have a YouTube channel from, you know, in the jungle. I like making wilderness videos, a wilderness survival instructor. Okay, those two things are still relevant. Everything else just kind of fell off the map, you know. It just doesn't exist anymore. There's no reason for it. And it was right about then I get this Facebook instant message, hey, you look like a great candidate for our show. Could you apply? And I look at this thing. Okay, alone. What show is this? And this is not my first run at Wilderness Survival. It's another guy hosting this show in Portuguese down in Brazil, and they went with the other guy. So I already kind of was familiar with the process of, you know, getting on TV. So I'm looking at this thing. We will send you to some location, some remote wilderness, anywhere in the world. You will stay there completely alone. There's no camera crew. You'll film it all yourself. No outside help, no food, no provisions, limited toolkit. You can, you know, satellite phone is your only safety net. Last person standing wins $500,000. I'm like, I can do that. Yeah. And the wilderness stuff didn't really scare me, but I know how it is with TV. This is a Hail Mary pass at life, right? So I fill out the application. I get a phone call, you know, an email back. They want to talk to me on the phone. Now they want to talk to me on Skype. Now they want me to go into the woods and give them an hour of footage. Going right through this casting process, then I stopped hearing from them. And I'm kind of wondering. Then this shows up, this giant package of background information. I've got to fill out all these forms about where every place I've ever lived, every job I've ever held, everything. They're doing an extensive background check on me. And I'm like, okay, now they're spending money. This is like $500, $600 worth of background check they're doing. And this looks good. You know, so at this point, I'm like, I have a chance at this. So I start running, I'm lifting, I'm eating like a horse, trying to build as much bulk, and ended up putting on about 10, 15 pounds of muscle and fat, you know, which becomes fuel when you're starving to death. But long story short, in August, I get invited to boot camp out in New York. Now, 3,500 people applied for season two. And out of that, they take 20 people to boot camp in New York, where they put you through your paces, give you a complete physical, like turn your head and cough kind of thing, and drug tests, personality profile, talk to the psychologist, and then you go out to the woods. And I get there, and I sign the non-disclosure agreement, and they pull back the curtain, they tell you everything about how the show is done, and I'm like, I have to do this. This is for real. I mean, I am so fired up about being the chance of doing this. I said, Lord, if you don't want me to do this, don't let them give me a chance to do it. just pull back and let me fail. Let me just be me without any, you know, divine intervention. Just let me fail, and well, I'll go home. I'll be okay with it. But if they offer me a chance, I'm just letting you know I'm taking it because that's why I think I might be here. Okay, I'm not going to turn it down. And that was fairly obvious. So I get out to the woods, and it's pretty intimidating, the people I'm there with, right? There's Jose Amoedo, former bodyguard of the King of Spain, Spanish Foreign Legion Special Forces. He lives in the Yukon and has been adopted by an Indian tribe. That's Jose. This big, good-looking Spanish guy. We're in New Jersey, and he's wearing his knife around the hotel. I'm like, all right. There's Mike Lowe. You've heard of the Air Force Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape course, SEER. That's the course that all the Air Force pilots go through to learn how to, if they're shot down, how to survive and get away from prison, all that stuff. Mike taught that course for his entire career in the Air Force. So I've got the instructor of the Air Force SEER school as competition. Dr. Nicole Appellian has a Master's of Marine Biology from Pacific Northwest, lived in Africa with the sand bushmen for like 2 years, did anti-poaching stuff in Africa. Okay, and there's me. It's like, hi, I taught kids Bible in Brazil, you know. I didn't feel like I had the street creds, you know, to hang with this group. So we get out there, and the first thing they had us do with in the field portion was to make a fire. Sounds pretty simple, right? But they gave us a piece of paracord about a meter long, and we could use our knife. Go make a fire. They want us to make friction fire right there in this forest we've never been in, which can be done, obviously, because I was the only guy that got it done. And of all the 20 people, they're all close, but I was the only one who had active fire burning away at the end of the time period they had us to do. And all of a sudden, I'm the guy to watch. And it was like, how'd that happen? You know what I mean? And of all the tasks they gave us to do, I was the only person that got every one of them done. And all of a sudden, everyone's kind of eyeing me up on this thing. A week after boot camp, they call me up and offer me a position as one of the 10 contestants on season 2 of Alone. And now it's like in a month, they're going to throw me against the wall to see if I stick, right? Had to shut down my life, make sure, you know, I could leave for an extended period of time. I spent every bit of my last money on gear for the show. 3 days before I was to go to leave, I took my guns over to my friend Gene's house for safekeeping. And a guy rear-ended me at like 40 miles an hour, totaled my Jeep. So my Jeep is totaled. It could drive, but it was like buck, right? And I'm driving home like this, like, what am I going to do? My daughter Erin moved into my apartment when I moved out because she was having some problems with my ex. And I get to the island, week of orientation week, learning how to do the cameras, safety training. The show is absolutely real as it's portrayed on TV. There is no back rubs and barbecue on the beach when the cameras are off. It's nothing like that. They don't even interact with you on the medical checks. They come out every 7 to 10 days, and it's just minimal interaction, and then they leave. It's like 15 minutes, and they're gone. That's a very hard thing to deal with, too, as it progresses. But anyway, it's the night before we're going to drop. Tomorrow morning, we're going to drop off in the bush. And I have no idea what's coming. This is not my first rodeo with starving in the wilderness. I've done this before many times. And I know how hard it's going to be. And that morning, I got out of bed. I didn't wake up. I got out of bed because I didn't sleep the whole night before. And I couldn't take my Bible with me. No Bible, no books, no pens, no paper. So I riffed through my Bible, and it opened it to Isaiah 40. And I looked at it, and it says at the top of my Bible, it says, comfort for God's people. That I could use some of that right now. You know, I'm going to read this chapter. So I'm reading through the chapter. It's fantastic. And I forgot that I had memorized the last verses of this chapter long ago. I forgot the reference totally. You get down to the end. It says, he gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Verse 29. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And people, I wept. I'm like, Lord, that's what you're telling me? Before I go do this, that's the last thing I'm going to read out of my Bible before I go out and do this thing of starvation in the wilderness, where I know my strength is going to be taken away. I will be weary. I will be weak. I will stumble. I will fall. And you're promising me that you're going to go with me and give me strength. And I took my rain jacket out, and I took out a pen, and I wrote these verses out on the inside of my rain jacket hood. I wanted that right here to remind me. And, you know, there wasn't a single time out there that I actually took the hood inside out and read that. I knew it was there, but it was here, you know. And there were times I would quote this verse I get through, "He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the..." And I'm too choked up to continue because I qualified for this, absolutely. Well, what is it like? What is wilderness survival all about? It's very simple. Your needs to stay alive are no more greater than a hamster's. If you have a little hamster and you have him in an aquarium and you keep him warm, dry, watered, and fed, he will get to be a hamster for as long as you continue to do that. Warm, dry, watered, and fed. That is the goal of wilderness survival. The disciplines of wilderness survival, shelter, fire, water, signals, navigation, and food gathering are the same no matter where you go. With shelter, fire, and water, that allows me to thermoregulate and hydrate. Okay, I can stay in a warm... If you're on a dry bed with an overhead waterproof cover and a fire burning in front of you and a pot of boiling water, what's that called? Camping. And that's the goal, is to get yourself in... You're not in a survival situation, you're just camping until you can figure it out. And that's the goal, is to get yourself into that place where I can stay here indefinitely, drinking water, eating food, living in a dry place, getting a natural night's sleep. That's what the whole focus of wilderness survival is all about, if you are stuck. Now, signals and navigation, that's how you get out of the bush. If I can signal the rescue to come to me, or I can navigate out to safety or to a road or something like that, then that's how I leave the bush. But in order to stay, you have to control your body heat and you have to hydrate. And that gives you 3 weeks before you're going to starve out. Okay, most people have about 3 weeks of survival reserve in terms of their own body fat. Some of you guys will last a lot longer, all right? And that's a good thing. That's a strategy. Season five, the guy who won alone put on 85 pounds before he went out to the bush. It's a winner. You get to eat that. You get to store that up and eat it back. So keep that in mind, Daniel. You got to put the poundage on. All right. He works very... This kid eats more than 5 brats in one sitting. He's a champion. Anyway, that's what it's all about. So I get dropped off. I pull into this rocky coastline, this cove over a bed of bull kelp forest and everything. There's camera gears up there. It's looking pretty good. And they drop me off on the beach. They say, okay, your camera gear's up there in a big black pelican case with a pink ribbon above it. And see you next week. There I am, okay? Shelter, fire, water. And by the end of that day, I had a shelter set up with one of my tarps. I had boiled my first pot of water on the beach there. I had shelter, fire, water my first day. So that night, I'm drinking boiled water and dry place to sleep, overhead cover, all that stuff set up. Now I know I've got 3 weeks, and I start looking for food. I've never set foot on the Pacific coast of Canada, British Columbia, ever. It's Vancouver Island, British Columbia, which they call it the rain coast. It gets 12 feet of rain a year, all right? It is jungle. It is a temperate rainforest. It is sopping wet everywhere you go. And I'm looking on this coastline for food, and I'm not seeing anything. And it was about a week before I actually got my first meal out of that cove. And that was just like shellfish and little tiny creatures I'm boiling, like a seafood boil. It was 2 weeks before I got my first fish. Caught my first fish on a line. I caught 2 fish in the same day. I think it was day 14 or 16. It was about 2 weeks in. At this point, I'm losing about a pound of weight a day. And I went out at about 198 pounds, almost 200 pounds. And I'm dropping a pound a day. And it's getting difficult. Now, how do you get yourself fed in the bush? There's 2 ways to do it. There's active hunting and fishing. Okay, if you have a bow, you are actively involved in the process of hunting game. You're using your most powerful weapon, your brain, to do that. Or you could take that brain and you could devise things like traps and snares and all that kind of stuff that's doing this passively. So while I'm sleeping, all my snares, those 200 snares I set up, are out working, trying to catch rabbits. All right, now in a marine environment, you want to do things like putting out trot lines. All the things that are illegal to do here in Michigan, like you put out a trot line. It's a long line. It's got a, 10 hooks or so, and they're all baited, and it's a commercial fishing technique. And we cannot do that here. Gill nets, where the fish swim through the net, and they get stuck on their gill plates, and they can't get out of that net. And you pull it up, and you take the fish out, and it's a commercial fishing technique. This is how you survive in the bush. You get as much of that passive fishing infrastructure set up as possible before you start actively fishing. So you're your presence is multiplied in all these different methods and places in trying to get as much animal life into your nets and hands as possible. I started doing that. I brought one gill net. I made a second gill net. I found this rope that was all dead, and I took the fibers out of that, and I made myself a net needle and got another rope put up there, and I actually wove a second gill net while I'm out there. Started that on day two, and knowing that I need this stuff in the water. Well, every time I go to check my gill nets, they're filled with bull kelp. Hundreds of pounds of bull kelp I'm straining out of that water into that net. Every time I set out a trot line, okay, it's got five hooks on it. I go there in the morning, it's been ripped out. It's gone. Because that bull kelp, which is like floating rope, just washing through the surf and catches those hooks and it's gone. And I'm losing hooks. I'm not catching fish. It's really getting frustrated. And I'm losing weight rapidly, rapidly, rapidly. And finally, it comes out to about day 30. And I get up in the morning and I go to check my nets. And during that, it was set up on a rock wall, and it was stretched both nets together, and there's a tripod here with a big rock, and I got it all tied down to that, and the surf during the night had knocked down that tripod, which is practically impossible, but it happened. And as the waves are rolling back and forth, it just tied that net into this ball, so it's tied up to my safety line. And I get out there, and I am just, I never swore on camera. 6 hours a day for all those days, never swore on camera, but there was a lot of days like this one where I shut that camera off because I knew it was coming, all right? And I am not the kind of guy who just goes around swearing, but yeah, you bang on my toes hard enough with a hammer, you're going to hear some things I probably shouldn't say, all right? And it was one of those days. I wanted to throw that net into the forest and just walk away from it, and I get the net up, and there's this enormous northern kelp crab in the middle of that net. And he's got claws like a lobster. And I'm like, all right, I can't just take my knife out and just cut him out. I know I have to start untangling this net. And as I'm untangling the net, it's like raining and blowing, and I'm not filming, and I'm just angry at life. I'm grumbling. I'm just really, really, and I'm like, oh, this is just killing me. I am doing everything I have taught other people to do. Get as much net in the water, get your hooks in the water, figure out where the game is and snag it up and do that. And just thing, everything just tearing up. Wave after wave of destruction just keeps tearing up everything I'm trying to do. And this is your life. It just hit me all of a sudden. This is your life. You know, day six, I was praying. I'm out there for a week and I said, Lord, you've taken everything away from me now. There's nothing left of my former life. I'm no longer a pastor, no longer a missionary, no longer own my own home, no longer a husband. I see my kids once every 2 weeks. I got some, you know, I'm not even employed right now. My Jeep got totaled. I spent the last of my money on gear for this show, and now you have literally exiled me to a rock on the north end of nowhere, where the only thing I have left to lose is my health or my life, and you've put me in the highest concentration of cougars and black bears on the planet. With no food, no weapons. It's all gone. There's nothing left. And whatever you're doing, I'm okay with it, because obviously you're doing something. Obviously you've got me at the end of some process, and if you want to take my life out here, it's yours. Never mind to begin with. And that's when he proceeded to starve me down. So now here I am at day 30, and I'm broken. Guys, I'm broke. You see me in those big bulky clothes on the show. I'm rattling around in them. I'm just a little stick man in there. I lost 35 pounds at this point. Like I weigh 192 right now. Imagine me, you know, 25 pounds less. It's not a good look. And this is my life. You know, people, when I was in Christian school, they gave me this very wrong-headed point of view. They said, if you really want your life to count for eternity, you got to be either a pastor, missionary, or a Christian school teacher. It's not true. Okay. But I had been all three at one point. You know what I mean? Any external observation of my life would say, this is a guy who wants his life to count for God. And I did. Vocational ministry in one form or another my entire career. And it's all come down to this. It's just the plug has been pulled. It's all been destroyed. There's nothing left. And now there's nothing left of even me. And I broke. I'm like, Lord. And he starts talking to me about me, showing me how I failed my wife. Because you go through a divorce and you're in defensive mode. You're not listening, okay? You're hearing about everything, every time you didn't tip a waitress enough, okay, you're hearing about it. It's just, it's all coming at you, you know, and you're just in defensive mode. I'm not listening. I'm not willing to consider these things. And all of a sudden, those defenses were all gone. It was just me and God, and he's letting me know, you know, yeah, you did neglect your wife, didn't you? You did not consider her at this point. And there were some things I had to repent of. I had to lay those on the line before the cross and say, yeah, Lord, I did that, and I confess, and will you forgive me? And what do you think he did? He forgave me. Okay? And one by one, he kept bringing things up. And one by one, I kept laying them down at the foot of the cross. And one by one, he gave me the grace and restored me those things. And then he stopped laying things down. He was apparently done. And he gave me like a five-minute breather. You know, I already cleaned out that bucket of rot. 5 minutes later, I look over here. Oh, wow, there's a whole other bucket of rot right there. But this bucket had people in it. This bucket had people in it that make a man want to buy a shovel and a bag of lime. And I'm not kidding. There's people in that bucket I laid awake at night for 2 years wanting to kill, as in dead. And I knew where I was going to hide the bodies. This wasn't just an off. This was a thing I germinated in my head until it grew some roots, right? Not good. There's people that failed us horribly. They were supposed to take care of us and look out for us and have our back, and they did not. And one by one, these people come up. And one by one, I had to feel the rage of what was happening, what had happened. And one by one, I had to forgive those men. Because here's how it works. You know, it's weird, third-party forgiveness, right? It's like, Daniel, I've offended you horribly. Jake, will you forgive me for that? Isn't that weird? Lord, I offended my wife horribly. I neglected her. Will you forgive me for that? How does that work? Because he did not go to her and ask permission. He didn't say, hey, I've got Mac on the beach, and he's just weeping his eyes out, asking me to forgive him. Is that okay with you? You were the one who was offended. Why is that? How does that work? I'll tell you why it works. Because he paid for those sins. He bought them. He owns them. Every sin I ever committed against anyone else out there, he paid the price for that for me. He owns them. And he gave me forgiveness. So now what am I going to do? That guy who did X to my family, oh, wait a minute, Lord. Is he going to get the same deal you gave me, like unconditional love and forgiveness? Whoa. Slow down. Because I want him dead. And that's not a figure of speech here. I want him dead. And he's not mine to kill, is he? Do not take your own revenge, but leave place for the wrath of God. Okay, there's something I can grab onto. He didn't rape my daughter, he raped your daughter. Okay, that makes sense. Because I know what I could do to him. You're better at it. And you know, if you want to forgive him and make him a trophy of your grace, what is that to me? Because I just received that from my God. Who am I to deny that to other people that Christ died for? He's already paid for those sins with his blood. He owns them. I don't. He forgave me. He'll forgive him. If that man doesn't ask God to forgive him, he's going to be crushed by a holy and living God who feared not him who can kill the body, but afterwards can throw the soul into hell. That's what he's got to deal with. He doesn't have to deal with me. He has to deal with God, and I'm good with that. And now I am no longer chained to that event. I can preach about it and talk about it without either flying into a rage or being a puddle of tears, because I know my God will do that, and he forgave me. So one by one, these people come up out of the bucket, feel the rage, letting them go. And I was light as a feather. There was nothing. That's a freedom appointment, by the way. That's what we do at Set Free Ministries. That's what we do. We lead people through that process. And if you need to do it, you need to do it. And it is fantastic. Anyway, I'm light as a feather. And I had that crab, too. Big old northern kelp crab. And he's dead. He's just like this. So I walk him back to my shelter and threw him on the wood pile. I'm making a fire. I'm going to boil my crab, you know. And he's dead, but he's still fresh. He's been in the water all night, you know. And I look over on the woodpile, and he's alive. He's like, what are you going to do about it? So I killed him. and I threw them in my pot, and I had this crab, and oh my goodness, they're like a miracle. They eat dead stuff in the bottom of the ocean and taste like crabs. That's pretty cool. So I'm eating this thing. I said, Lord, when I get out of here, I'm going to one of those all-you-can-eat crab places. I'm going to eat so many crabs, they're going to lose money on me. It's going to be fantastic. And it's like 3 days later, I'm fishing in the evening, and the tide's coming in or going out. It was like at half tide. And all the bull kelp is laid over like this. So I'm looking through the water about 6 feet down. I've got my pole with a line and a hook and a limpet, which is a little shellfish on the end for bait. And over in the corner of my eye, I see this. I look over, and there's a northern kelp crab on his back on the top of the kelp. I'm like, yeah. I drop the limpet on him. Boom, he grabs the limpet, and I pull on him. He locks into the kelp, and I'm pulled on him. He's pulling on the kelp. I'm fighting him. He's fighting me. I got tired of it. I relaxed. He relaxed. And whew, just like this. He's up in the rocks, so I got him. I look out now, and I got five more. I got six kelp crabs right there at that one location. I realized, okay, I can see them. You know, they blend right with the kelp. They were there all along. I just never really saw them. And so now I'm catching kelp crabs. I go home and have my all-you-can-eat crab feast. It's like the Lord said, no, I don't have to send you home for that. You're here on Vancouver Island. We can do that right here. You know, so the Lord and I had a bucket of crabs that night. It was wonderful. Up until this point, I'd always been fishing on my reef. I started pretty much stopped using the nets and set lines and all that and just used a line and a hook. And more days than not, I was catching fish. So I was fishing out on the reef one day and realized I'd never been, northwest side of my cove, there was a cliff you come to. And no matter what time of day, you get there and you just came to this cliff and you couldn't proceed down the coast. And that kept the bears from coming in on me because they hunt the coastline. So they didn't come into my cove. It was kind of nice. But I thought, I've never been there at dead low tide. I've never seen what that area looks like at dead low tide. So this one day, I foregoed fishing where I knew I could catch fish and went to a place I was taking a risk at it. But I followed the tide as it's going down. And the tide there is like 8-9 feet a day. It's really huge. So as the tide's getting lower and lower, all of a sudden I get through this passage into the rocks. I can get farther down the coast if I come here at dead low. And as the tide got lower and lower, there was a whole other set of cliffs there. This little rocky trail opens up around the bottom. As it's about 3/4 tide going down, I can get around that. And now all of a sudden I've got 400 or 500 yards of untouched coastline, which I haven't been picking over and fishing. And it was just like getting a raise. You know, it's just like finding out your neighbor bought you an Angus steer and put it in a locker. And hey, all you want to, you know, all you can eat. Wow. So I started fishing and all that. The first day I go out there, I'm exploring it. I didn't explore it with a camera. I set the camera up as I'm walking away because it's like, no way. I got to cover this whole thing before I and get back. I got to know what's here. And I'm going there and I find this tide pool. You know, when the tide comes up, it floods everything. And then as it recedes, there's places where that water is retained. And as it keeps going down, I find a tide pool. It's about the size of a small swimming pool, like a backyard swimming pool. And I look in there, and there's 5 northern kelp crabs that have been hanging out in this pool. And I have my fishing line, so I caught 5 more crabs. Okay. And before I left, I took the mussels, the shellfish that filter the water. They were poisonous because there was red tide poisoning, so I couldn't eat them. But I took a bunch of them, like a half a bucket of them, crushed them up, threw them in that tide pool. Come back the next day, 5 more crabs. I've made a slot machine for crabs. You put in the poisonous mussels, and you come back, and the sweet and delicious crabs are there. So that became something I would check every day, and that was like my main passive fishing system. And I would usually get, if not 1 or 2, 3, maybe 4 crabs out of that pretty much every day. And by baiting that tide pool and coming back every day, and plus there was some really fantastic fishing places there, in the second month I'm there, I was actually regaining lost weight. I'd lost 35 pounds, and now I'm slowly regaining weight, and feeling much better about myself, but it's dragging on and on and on. I mean, it's like Groundhog Day out there. You're living the same day over and over and over, doing the same tasks, the same things, missing the family, near starvation, you know, gaining weight, but I think the first 10 pounds of that weight I was regaining was just refilling my intestines, believe it or not, because there was nothing there. And it was hurting. It goes, and you get to a point where you're already applying the best of your ideas to the best of your discoveries. Okay, my motto out there was make tomorrow an easier day. No matter what I do today, make tomorrow an easier day. Okay, and I'm not, the best of my ideas are being applied to the best of my discoveries, and I'm kind of peeking out. where I'm getting food more days than not, like eating, if not every day, every other day, getting one meal. And if I can keep doing this, I can stay. But it's not like a pod of whales is going to beach and I'm going to get to eat them. It's not like I'm going to train the otters to bring crabs to me rather than selfishly eating them out there where I can see them. Can you imagine? These sea otters, they go down, they get a crab, they have a little rock, and they're like, hey, you can't do this. They're not going to help me out, you know? And the best I can hope for is to repeat a day where I get a meal and a night's sleep. And that was as good as it's going to get. And I remember it got to day 64. I went there 2 months, you know? And I caught this little tiny fish. And all day long I'm fishing, I'm looking around for fish and crabs and getting nothing. It's just nothing. And I get to the end of the day, and I've been all the way to the end of my northwest coast. Now I'm coming back. My camera's like frozen up with fog, and it's just really, I'm just really angry at the filming. I don't want to do it. And I get to a place I call the fight chair. It's a really good place to sit on this one rock and catch fish. And I had been skunked there, and now I'm back at this place. And this is like the last place I need to get around before the tide comes in. And this is, you know, the last place I can sit and fish with a good chance of getting fish before I have to depart that trail or I get trapped on the northwest coast. So I'm sitting there, and I got my head down. I'm grumbling. I'm not filming. There's like sleet falling out of the sky. It's windy and cold and miserable. My hands are numb. I'm just grumbling, you know. And I'm sitting there. I got my bait in the water. I'm at the top, and I'm like, Lord, when is this going to stop? I mean, I'm not learning anything new. I'm not learning anything new about me, about you, about anything, about life. I'm just suffering out here, and there's obviously someone else is suffering too. When is this going to end? That's what I'm thinking. Go down, stand on that rock, cast in the bull kelp. My voice in my head, not my idea. And I'm like, what? I look down, and there's a flat rock down there by the water. Tide's still coming in, so the bull kelp is still floating on top of it. And the waves are coming past me, like this way. I'm like, well, that's dumb. Why would I go all the way down there, risk falling in the water, and cast into bull kelp, which steals my hooks? I'm just like rejecting this thought totally. I put my head down. Go down, stand on that rock, and cast into the bull kelp. Real loud. My voice, my head, not my idea, but insisting. And I said, okay, I'll do this. So I go down, I stand on that rock. And I look, and here in the bull kelp, there's like a vacant spot, a hole in it, you know, which is not obviously going to snag my hook. So it goes like this, and I throw my bait out there, and the next wave goes out, and bam, I'm snagged in the bull kelp. It's just like rocked into the bull kelp. Now I'm just like going nuts, right? I'm losing it. Now I'm losing it. I'm not even making sound choices here. And the next wave comes in like this, and my line's still going out to sea. And I'm like, what? I pull back on that. People, this fish comes out of the water. Gigantic sea perch. He was landing in the rocks behind me, and I had in my jacket, I had this big nail I found. I took this pink ribbon and made a handle for it. I called my pink handle prison shank, right? And it was actually tied into my jacket because it was so valuable. I jump on this fish. I'm shanking this fish like you wouldn't believe. I'm like, and blood's flying up, and I'm laughing, and I'm crying at the same time. I get this fish off the thing. I set the camera up. I said, people, this is the grace of God. This is God taking care of me. And they didn't use that visual. They did use that audio. They used me saying that, but not with that crazy, you know. They did me a solid favor on that because nobody hired me after that. It's like, no, dude, you got a side to you. We don't want to keep around. So, and you get to live with it. It's so free. Huh? Anyway, I go home, and that fish was so big, I had a two-quart pot, and I filleted the fish out, and he filled up half that pot. So there was a quart of meat on that fish, all right? And I made myself some fish and seaweed stew, and I could barely finish it that night. That was day 64. Day 65, I got up in the morning, had a really good day, caught like 3 fish and a couple crabs that night, had a really good meal, really beautiful day, just very calm, no weather at all. And that night I went to bed, and I woke up about 1:30 in a forest morning, and it was bright. Now, Vancouver Island's a dark place. You're in a forest, which is like 100 feet tall, very thick forest, overcast constantly, and raining. And I wake up and there's like patches of moonlight on my tarp. And I go out, I had to go to the bathroom, so I go out there and it's like moonlight in the forest and it's really beautiful and really calm but cold, like 30 degrees. So I went to the bathroom and all I'm thinking at this point is I got to get back in my sleeping bag before it cools off. I don't want to have to heat it up again. And I go to turn to go into the shelter. If you knew this was your last night in the bush, you'd go out to the beach and have a look. I'm like, yeah, if I knew that, but how can I know that? You know, I'm cold. If you knew this was your last night in the bush, you go out to the beach and have a look. I'm like, all right, Lord, I don't know what to make of that, but I'm going to go out to the beach and have a look. And I turned on my headlamp and went out. I spent about a half hour, 40 minutes out there on the beach. And it was kind of a no-no because I wasn't wearing my GPS tracker. I was charging in my bed, and the crew would have no idea where I went. They think I was in my bed. So I stayed out there, beautiful. Cuatzino Sound was a sheet of glass where I had seen this place with 60-mile-an-hour winds, you know, when breakers come across that beach. It's a sheet of glass. There's not a ripple on the ocean. And the water at the edge is just kind of heaving up like this. It's not even breaking. Full moon, stars, really beautiful. So I went to bed, and I woke up the next day. It was going to be med check, day 66, and you guys get to see that back here. So there I was, you know. That moment when I turned around and saw my daughter there, I had some thoughts run through my head. Number one is, other than my daughter's here, you know, I'm done. I don't have to continue doing this anymore. I was there to continue. I wasn't giving up that day. I would have been probably until day 80 at least. But that was my first thought, I'm done. The other thought was, I'm not broken. Because I was convinced I was going out on a backboard at some point, I'd break a bone and be medically evacuated from this thing because it's very dangerous. And I saw Aaron's here. Oh, that means I'm done. And I'm not broken. This is, you know, the thought of winning the money or the show or whatever, that comes later. But he gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. You hear me say I'm going home in that boat, right? I didn't go home in a boat. They will soar on wings like eagles. Amen. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Well, I had to stay there on the island for another week just to acclimatize to being around people and not being a total savage. And they land that helicopter. They had to keep us incognito for a while. They don't want the locals to know who's coming off and in what order from the show. So they're hiding me away at these cabins, and they say, okay, there's two cabins for you and Aaron. You know, you pick one, and Aaron can pick the other. And I walk into my cabin, and there over the bed is this giant picture of a bald eagle soaring over Cuatzino Sound. And I'm like, all right, Lord, I get it. I get it. So I asked the people, is the artwork for sale here? They're like, this is Canada. Yes. I shelled out $220 Canadian, and I'm now a patron of the arts. I put that picture's hanging in my house, that eagle, because that goes directly back to this. And I told the people there about this verse and what it meant to me. And right after, in the last episode, after the last guy, Larry, drops out, they cut to this eagle because of this verse, because they knew a fish off the water. And that was, they did that because of this verse, because they knew what that meant to me. And then when it comes up, it says, you know, day 66, one person remains. They have this overhead drone shot of an eagle flying to the coast, and it's all related to what they did here. They did not edit my Christianity out of my story on the show, not at all. In fact, several of the producers are believers, and the first five people to win alone were believers. Okay, no, seasons 1, 2, 3, and 5 have all been believers, and 6 and 7. So, yeah, and they noticed that. They've noticed that. Anyway, so after the show, I go all around the country speaking about this experience and doing that and telling basically the same story in one form or another. And COVID comes along and wipes out a year's worth of meetings all set up. My entire schedule just wiped clear. And I'm like, all right, Lord, what do you want me to do? So I prayed about it. I said, Lord, put me in the line of battle where you want me to be and give me the grace to stand, because obviously this is not going to be something that will continue to support me. And about a week later, Dean Vandermeer from Set Free Ministries calls me up and wants me to take me out for breakfast and proposes that I consider the job of international director there. I had spoken at their fundraiser in 2018, and now 2 years later, they're asking me to come on board as international director. So I've been doing that for the last 2 years, and it's like all the, my theological education, all my cross-cultural experience, all that stuff is now back in play. And I'm, I have 10 primary schools I work with in Uganda with about 3,600 students, and other things going on in India, which I'm not as directly involved with, but everything that the Lord took away, he gave back. And I just praise him. So don't look at me and think, oh, he spent a lot of time, you know, 66 days on Vancouver Island. He must be a strong man. No. You know he took away my strength. I had no strength, but he gave me strength. I'm not a strong man. I'm a weak man who knows where to find strength. And that's available to you, too, in the midst of your suffering. Okay? The other thing don't go away with is if you do business with God, he's going to cut you a big check. Doesn't work that way. Okay? And the government comes in and takes 200,000 of that right off the top anyway. So, yeah, I bought the federal government a house in the state of Michigan, an SUV with that. Well, anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. And thank you for being patient and listening.